Title of the talk today is Inviting Difficulty to Share Our Home. And the subject actually came when, can you hear me at the back? Okay. When I was sitting next to the stage here, and Bartel was giving instructions this morning, and I had a visitor, which was a fly. And the fly did what flies do. They always seem to love noses, especially mine. So as it kind of did its walking meditation on and around my nose, I thought, well, I reflected that I gave a talk yesterday on being with. Does it include flies on the nose? And that I should give another talk, kind of a follow-up, being with number two, called Being with the Fly on the Nose. Well, the most beautiful thing was that straight after that I went to a group, and the first person that spoke in the group started to speak, and she said, there was a fly on my nose. And she had some reflection about this. Only happens on retreat, situations like that. So that really confirmed it. Sounds a bit crazy, by the way, because not only does it only happen on retreat, but if anyone outside the retreat would hear me talking about the story of the fly on the nose, they'd think this was not a retreat, this is madhouse, there's crazy people here, they're not in the real world at all. But very soon the discussion in the group said, okay, fair enough with flies, but what if they're elephants? What if the difficulty is really big? What if the pain is significant? And being with doesn't really work. It's not enough. Something is needed, something else. The pain in the body, for example, is just a lot. I need to do something with it. Calm abiding doesn't seem to deal with it, or it's not enough. So I want to explore that whole area of difficulty, working with difficulty, and beyond that, being at home with difficulty in our lives. I think the fly does tell us one thing, the same thing as our thoughts tell us, that we can't control life. We just can't do it. We can't control the way the fly chooses to sit on our nose. We can't control the way our thoughts choose to arrive, whether we like them or we don't like them, whether they're good for us, whether we're happy thoughts or unhappy thoughts, patterns, judgments, anger, angry thoughts, thoughts carrying pain, thoughts that are just so stupid and irrelevant, and they're so intimate and so much part of us, and in that intimate so much part of us, we still can't control them. So if we can't control our thoughts, what can we control? We can't control our bodies. Our bodies do exactly what they want. They get old, they get sick, they fall over. If we can't control our bodies, can we? Can is there anything? What can we control? And this is not a philosophical question. It's there's some urgency in it because the effort to control is huge. We spend most of our life trying to control the uncontrollable. We are busy from morning to night, from birth to death, to try and control. To get the food we need, to get the support we need, to get the house we need, to get the relationships we need, to get the money we need, to get the health we need, to get the beauty we need, to whatever, all the time. So this is consuming our life. The effort to control the uncontrollable, to minimize the uncontrollable, to make it as controllable as possible, to keep things as same as possible. Mostly, the self takes it on as the big mission. The self, ha'ani, me, takes on this mission. And that's where the battle happens, because the uncontrollability of life and the self that takes on a total dedication all its life to control the uncontrollable. Most of the thoughts we think are about trying to predict what will happen, what will need to be looked at or looked after, what will be, how I can prevent it, how I can make it better, how I can get what I need. That's most of the thoughts. And if we are, by the way, we move from that place of trying to control the uncontrollable, I would say 99% of our thoughts can just disappear. And good riddance. We don't need them. They're all about trying to control the uncontrollable, trying to predict, trying to work out what will happen, trying to work out the best thing for me. So it's total devotion to the survival mind. That's what this body mind is trying to do. Trying to survive. And it's natural. It doesn't mean to say immediately we have to commit suicide. It's just natural. Every animal does it. Every human does it. Every ant does it. Every virus and every fly. The fly is doing just the same as we are, from a different point of view. It reminds me of this story, by the way, in brackets, that I heard just before I came, about a man going to a doctor, and the man said, "I've got something very weird on me." And the doctor says, "What is it?" He said, "I'll take off my hat and I'll show you." So he took off his hat, and there was a frog sitting on his head. And the doctor looked at it and realized that the frog is not sitting on the head. There's no place where the head and the frog are separated. They're just one thing. The frog is sitting here and they're totally connected. And the doctor says, "Well, how long has that been like that?" And the man says, "Well, I was sitting in the pond and I saw a little pimple on my belly and it started to grow." the man was the pimple. That's all a story about point of view. So when we stop and we give ourselves a chance and a bit of space to examine what is, and that's what we're doing here, we just stop. And deeply ask ourselves, perhaps not intellectually, but with an open interest in what is, we ask ourselves, really what's happening to me, then we begin to see this constant busyness with controlling or trying to control the uncontrollable. We see the uncontrollable, and we see the effort we make, and we see the pain in that. And it needs to be revealed. And if we don't reveal it, we're a slave to it. And we're on automatic pilot, trying to sort the uncontrollable the whole of our life. And when we see it, it may be a shock and it may be very uncomfortable. The one thing we're doing here is actually not running away, not denying, not pushing away, not escaping. And that's a very important thing. It's in a way a much bigger thing than just going, as we said before, going to retreat to have a kind of protected space and feel we can stop and relax and be calm. A much bigger thing is we can stop and see and stop running away and stop trying to control things and get out of that that cycle. And when we stop running away, it allows the pain to appear. And many of you are experiencing it already. Many of you are experiencing that what we're trying to control when we stop just arises, appears. And things that we try and bury and we try and avoid and we try and sew up and we try and run away from surface in the space that we give them. That we allow things to emerge. By the way, we can't predict exactly in the same way as we look at the unknown world, we can't actually predict what will come up for us. Our kaze, the menu of the day or the menu of this sitting, doesn't say first will come pain in the back, second will come judgmental mind, third will come, and then you can play this. Well, I prefer judgmental mind, is that okay? The pain as it comes up will come in its own way, in its own time, and it may not come, there may be no painful experience this particular retreat or this particular day or this particular sitting, or there may, or it may take a certain form, and this is the uncontrollability of things. And we can't design our experience here in the hall or anywhere else. So it takes its own shape, just as we have our own shape. And we have our own biography or track in the world. So things come up in their own way. And it can be anything on the level of emotional pain, stress in the body, memory, things that bug us. It can be patterns, it can be anxiety, it can be obsessions, it can be falling asleep, it can be anger, it can be reactivity, it can be anything. And see all the ecology out there, thousands of flowers in the spring, and there's an ecology in us, and all that, it's all growing, it's all coming out. So the work we need to do with it is a bit more than calm abiding, as it's a bit more than being calm and steady. So let's look a little bit at this being with and how it works with something which is bigger than a fly on the nose. It's an elephant. So how do we work with the elephant? I think that at this point I should bring in mindfulness as as a kind of a label or a description of being with. Mindfulness, sati in the Pali, it's the capacity to be very attentive, very close, very aware of something. And it's our ability to turn the light or shine the light on something. Our mind has a huge capacity, and we bring this with the focus that I mentioned yesterday of samadhi, or gathering our mind together, this huge power, this huge light, if you like. We gather it together and we turn towards the object, the phenomena, what's coming up for us. We turn towards it and hold it in our attention. And that's sati, mindfulness. Full of mind, mindfulness. It's still a translation. Mindfulness has in it the understanding that we will also forget, we will also switch off. So it has a quality of remembering to be aware, to collect and recollect ourselves again and again, to remember to be aware. We know that we can be aware for a while and then we kind of lose it. We're lost in thoughts, we're gone, we're in somewhere else. And this act of bringing back the attention is included in mindfulness sati. And sampajana is a word that's used along with sati in the traditional description, and it means to be aware of something, such as the breath or such as a pain in the body, but to be aware of it as it arises and goes, to be aware of the beginning and the end of it, clear comprehension, to be clear about it, to see it as it is coming and going, and to see something about its context, how it is, what happens when the pain arises, is there and disappears. It's a sense of phenomenology. It's a looking at things as phenomena and not as uncontrollable problems that just take us over. It's allowing things to be phenomena, happenings, events that arise, that we can examine with the consciousness, with the awareness, with attention, clearly seeing as they come, seeing as they go. And it has in it this quality of not escaping, not avoiding, looking at directly, not preferring, not choosing just the nice ones. Yes, pain, emotion, stress in the body, difficult thoughts, difficult memories, the whole lot, patterns. There's no choosing the rose and not the thorns. Rose has thorns. We look at the rose and we look at the thorns. Looking at the rose, or trying just to look at the rose, is all about the habits of ordinary life. That's exactly what we're trying not to do now. We're looking at the truth of things as they are, and that includes thorns along with the rose. As we do this, something happens that that underneath, as we do this, underneath something is changing, or quite a few things are changing. And one of the things that's changing is we learn to be intimate with the changing life as it appears. There is an intimacy that we begin, and we stop running away, we stop escaping from difficulty, we stop burying it or pushing it down. We allow more stuff to come up. Sometimes we touch the unconscious stuff comes up, things that we don't even know, that are there, we begin to expand the awareness. The awareness expands. There's more allowable territory. The awareness begins, we practice intimacy with more of our life. And that's important because it's expanding the mind. When we include those things that we don't like, we're actually expanding the mind. We're actually expanding our power to receive life. And it makes life less of things there that give us trouble. A pain in the body becomes less of a thing. We made it a thing when all we do with it is push it away or give it paracetamol, Acomol, and get rid of it as fast as we can. We make it in that process, we push it away, we turn it into a thing. There's me here and the thing there we don't like. And we go, if it's a psychological thing, we get it diagnosed by a psychologist who says, you've got a thing called, usually with letters like OCD or whatever it is, you've got a thing, and let's kill it. We've got a disease called, I don't know what, back pain disease or whatever. Here's a drug, get rid of it. So as we invite in phenomena, which is our life, we invite in these phenomena, we are with in intimacy, the world itself stops being, or is less like, less looks like me against things, the pain, the this, the that. Intimacy grows. So for example, with a pain in the shoulder or in the arm, in the back, we begin to see that it actually is a lived experience. It's part of us. It changes. It has sharpness. It has dullness. It has movement. It is there for a moment. It's there and it's gone. It makes reaction. We fight it or we don't like it. Okay, include that as well. What's our reaction? What's our responses? So this pain then becomes something very rich for us, becomes a lived experience, and as we do that, we gain more intimacy with the lived experience, and the pain changes. The pain is not just enemy. It becomes part of our lived experience. We gain it back. Sometimes difficulties are strong, and this came up in the group today, that it's too strong for me. I can't deal with the pain. I look at it, and after a few minutes, I feel the pain is just too strong. It's too stressful, and it begins to take me over. And yes, that's right. With physical pain, sometimes, and emotional pain, most of the time, it can be very strong. It can be, in a sense, too strong for our mindfulness. And then we feel, well, I can't deal with it, or it's taking me over, or whatever. And this is where it's the elephant and not the fly. Okay. In such a case, we have to understand that we are growing another way of looking. And that all our life, actually, we've been doing something else. So we've been busy all our life with pushing away, denying, trying to sort things out, trying to get the world safe, and so on, and trying to push things down, and trying to stop the pains of this kind and any other kind. And all of a sudden, we stop and we say, okay, let everything come up. We've been doing it 3 days against, on the one hand, all our life, on the other hand. So we can't expect that instantly our mindfulness is going to be so strong that it will be able to actually include and demolish difficulty that's strong for us. So what we do is we nibble away, just bit by bit, we nibble away strong difficulty. We touch with our mindfulness and go. We understand that our mindfulness may not be so strong. We have some sympathy for it. We have some compassion for ourselves and our situation. We just touch and go. If the pain is very strong, we can touch it. We look at it with mindfulness. We see it. We do not ignore it. We do not run away. But at a certain point, we say, yeah, okay, that's enough. I'm changing my posture. I will move my body. It's no longer, the pain is too much. I can't, in a way, hold it in my attention. So at that point, okay, fine, change the posture. I'm doing it right now. Change the posture. But then again, we'll come again, we do it again. So slowly, slowly, with patience, and it may take retreats. It may need time, it may need the process, it may need us to keep going with it. If we're busy trying to do this practice in order to stop the pain, we're actually in the old mind of trying to control the uncontrollable. So we turn our attention and we just, in a sense, find intimacy and find a connection. We become partner with difficulty, but we also know the limits. With emotional pain, it's very common. Anger and grief and anxiety and all kinds of heart pain can be very strong. Fear, it can be very strong. And the reason they're very strong is they're a kind of package that takes all of us. It includes hormones, it includes body reactions, it includes memory and thought, it includes heart pain of suffering, inner suffering, it includes the unconscious and it includes the conscious. It's all over the place. And so it's quite difficult sometimes with emotions to be mindful of emotions. The mindfulness is a kind of like a little growing shoot, still katan, and it just can't deal with this big emotion. Tsunami arises. So one useful place to work with emotion is the body, and we're looking, in a way, the body for us is a territory where it's much easier to watch the manifestation of mind. It's just easier. Mind manifests in the body. Mind and body are one, they flow together. Mind appears through the image of body, the experiences of body. So body is for us a place, if we're kind of practicing body awareness, we will pick up everything in the body. And so emotions appear in the body, and they may appear as a contraction or heart pain or tummy pain or not breathing freely or sense of stress and other things too. But at least you can say, okay, I'll cut it down to size. I will look at this demon just a little bit. I will look at the demon Bhagava Enaim straight in the face, and I will just look at this part, and that will be my handle on the emotion rather than the whole lot. So we kind of a little bit break down the emotion into some elements where we can be more mindful, where it's possible to be more mindful. A story that maybe you've heard before, but it's a personal story, was that many, many years ago I used to be a lecturer at London University, and I used to teach biochemistry and medical science, and I was terrified of speaking in front of people. It was like, for me, I wanted the world, I wanted a big hole to open up and swallow me. and I was so frightened. I would come into the class and there would be like, they had these lecture theatres which were up like that. So there was like people all the way up, and like 100 and 120 students all all over, and I was there like a little kind of mouse at the bottom. And so it was really affecting my life as a university teacher, and of course outside the university too. And I work with it in two ways. One was when I used to go into the class about 2 minutes before I needed to give a lecture, and at that time I would stand there and all the symptoms would arise. The symptoms in the body were stomach contracting, sweat pouring, mouth dry, heart beating like crazy, heat, and you know, probably a few others. It was quite and fear, a lot of fear on the emotional side that I wouldn't know what to say. I'd have nothing to say, or I wouldn't know what to say. And what I used to do is just breathe and see the contraction in the belly. And feel the contraction in the belly. Breathe and feel the contraction in the belly. Took one, basically one thing, one symptom from this whole complex called fear of speaking in public. And just sort of sat, stood with that, felt the belly, felt the contraction, let it go a little bit, let the belly get soft, felt the breath inside, calming. And then a little bit as I was doing it, watching things change, watching the, you know, the breath get back to the heartbeat, get back to normal a little bit. And I kept doing it in the class itself and the whenever I felt the fear. And also I work with it in retreats. Just anytime a memory came up of speaking in public, all the symptoms came, but light, but they were there and enough to work with. And so I used to kind of work with them, feel them just as phenomena. It's not me. It's a stomach contracting. It's not me. It's heart just starting to beat. Oh, heart beating. Oh, hello, heart. You're racing. Okay. Maybe you can slow the pace a little bit. You don't need to race. Hello, stomach. Oh, again? Oh, okay. There you go again. Just phenomenologic. Here it is, phenomena that arise by themselves. That way, it took time. It does take time. Patterns take time. But it's this way you can work with emotions, any emotion, just by taking a slice of the experience and touching it. I think friendliness is a kind of underlying attitude that we need for this. We need to be a friend of ourselves. We have so many messages all our life telling us to be against and telling us that we are maybe not so good or maybe not so precious. One attitude that we can keep remembering is that we are very, very precious, and that there is absolutely no reason that we cannot be our own best friend, and that this friendliness can underline or can be the ground on which we practice. So it's just a small reminder that friendliness is another way in which we find, in a sense, healing from the unpredictability and from the pain. And just a sense that no blame. If there is a difficulty, don't add to it saying, I shouldn't have pain. There should be some other way. It's that voice which is trying to kind of control things that says, pain, you've got something wrong, you are wrong, or you are not successful, or you are not smiling, or you are not, it's adding blame and adding some sort of guilt to the fact that we have pain and suffering. The First Noble Truth of the Buddha says it's in the nature of things that the lived experience will include suffering. It's in the nature of things. It's not something that is just my problem, that I've been picked out by life and there's something wrong with me. It's in the nature of things. Not suffering in the nature of things, in the nature of things that our experience will include suffering. Suffering isn't in the nature of things, it's not in life. It's not sitting out there in the universe. It's when we experience the unpredictability, uncontrollability, and change, and our efforts to control that, and that every animal, every being will do that. And we'll feel that. Some scientists wrote, saw a popular article about the brain that was describing the state of the brain, and as the kind of background state of the brain is constant mild anxiety. It's kind of the background state. The default state. I think it's probably a deeper default state called joy. I think joy is a deeper default. But let's say there's another default on the joy called constant anxiety or readiness, watching out what could be wrong or what is wrong. So it's there. But by seeing it, by becoming friends with it, by becoming partners with it, by intimacy with it, by touching it and going, touching it and going, we get, it's not that we attack it or get free of it, we just become bigger than it. So we can have experiences that are painful at any time, but we are a bigger vessel, we are a bigger container, mechal. We are a container of our experience, and we're simply bigger than the change that appears, the change that comes and goes. We can contain, we can be free along with the changes that come and go that we wanted to control. I also mentioned in the group yesterday, three images that actually comes from the Sufi tradition of dealing with the difficulty or discomfort. Three metaphors. One is the basket. The wind blows, the basket rolls over, but the basket is very light and free. And so the wind will blow the basket, but it always ends up same, not destroyed. The basket rolls and is fine, and ends up sitting there quite happy, and unharmed. Another one is the rock, and the rock is in a way what we've been doing here too. It's like sitting steady, a certain steadiness, a certain solidity. We are here. I take my place on my seat. The fact that we sat 45 minutes and didn't jump up every, like we often do, oh, I need this, oh, this is hurting me, I better change, oh, you know, constantly reacting and changing in response to difficulty, trying to dance to the tune of whatever discomfort arises. Instead of that, we are learning to sit steady in the middle of things, to be the eye of the storm, to be in the eye of the storm, just to sit there. So that's the rock, and it is another quality that helps us. And the third is really what I've been talking about, which Surya Das kept saying, be like Teflon, have a Teflon mind that doesn't stick, non-stick. Things don't stick, they just come and they go. It's like being transparent. Things arise and they go. Things arise and they go. We don't control, we just let them, but they don't stick. They don't sit in us. They don't grow in us as issues, problems that has to be worked on, that are growing like a kind of fungus inside us. So there are three images that you might like to remember. As we practice, we develop some kind of steadiness, equanimity. Equanimity or steadiness is not censoring or stopping. It's not being indifferent or pushing away experiences, adishut. It's what we've been talking about, the ability to have no resistance, to be not resisting, being with, trusting, getting wet, getting ourselves wet, getting in the water, getting in the waves in the sea, but kind of surfing the waves, being, allowing the waves and being with them, surfing the waves, not staying in your five-star hotel, shutting the door and putting on the air conditioning and saying, I'm not going to get wet, I'm not going in the water. Getting in the water, getting wet, but riding the waves. I want to quote a small poem from the suttas about fear and about what I've been talking about. Always frightened is this mind. The mind is always agitated about problems that haven't yet risen and about problems that already have risen. If there exists a release from fear, please tell me, declare it to me. And the Buddha's answer was, it's not apart from awakening and renunciation, austerity or simplicity, not apart from working with the senses, not apart from letting go, do I see safety for any living beings. So what he's saying there is that safety, real safety, real protection, is not in trying to sort the world, but in awakening, in our path to freedom. That there is real safety, because the safety that we're looking for when we try and control life is not real safety. It's just more vulnerability. But only if we're only in the awakening process can we find real, I would say, real safety. And it's because of being with the world. The world in us and us in the world. It's being with things, that we're no longer having to protect ourselves against things. We're no longer having to separate ourselves from things and control them, which is what we're doing. Instead of that, the sense of freedom is for us safety. It's safety in relationship. We see ourselves in total relationship. So there is safety, because there's nothing to fight. There's nothing to struggle against. We're in relationship with. So what are we trying to fight? Where can we? We are with. The world is with us. We are with. And in this dynamic, changing world of relations, that's the safety. Another quote, monks, be islands to yourselves, be a refuge to yourselves with no other refuge. Let the Dhamma be your island, let the Dhamma be your refuge with no other refuge. And how do you be an island to yourself here, a monk or a meditator? Practitioner abides, he stays, contemplating the body as body. Ardent, aware, mindful, put aside the cravings for things and for the world and fretting for the world, he stays contemplating feelings as feelings, mind as mind, mind objects as mind objects, clearly aware, keen, energetic, ardent. So that's being an island, being with the body as the body, the phenomena of the body, the phenomena of feelings, the phenomena of emotions, the phenomena of here, this is the universe, it's right here, the universe is right here. So seeing things as they are, that's our home. It's not some mindful practice that we read in a book, and it's bringing us to a deeper sense of home. It is arriving back to our real home. Our real home is in this this dynamic relationship with this universe here and the universe there. It's in the dynamic relationship itself is home. And if we look at it like that, we're actually always at home. We can never leave home. There isn't any other place besides home. Where else is there except home? And the sense of refuge, sense of refuge in a deeper place. The way things are is our refuge. The dynamic nature of things is our refuge, our home, our protection, if you like. And the fly is just a fly. And things are just as they are. So I want to finish with a poem by Mary Oliver. Which is about this, finding an ultimate or deeper home. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over, announcing your place in the family of things. So let's sit for a few minutes.